Ah, state budget season, when spreadsheets, obscure government agencies, and programs reign supreme, and decisions. Who gets the money and who doesn't?
Imagine a big family, right? It's easy to say, no Christmas gifts this year. It's really hard to say, well, Mary and Bob get a Christmas gift, but the rest of you kids get nothing.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, we break down the budget process, sans abacus. Also, Glendale will officially start talking with the Tohono O'odham Nation about its proposed casino, why Arizona is looking to bring in some brand name companies, and a festival of creativity in Mesa.
They have a place to take those risks of things that might not work out. They may have to try a different thing, or maybe parts of them don't even end up working, but that's okay.
Kind of like a metaphor for this show. Also today, smuggled smokes, high art, and you will not believe what else. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein is out today. I believe he may be suffering from a busted bracket. It should be a beautiful rest of the day today and weekend as well. Sunny skies, highs in the lower 80s. It's 80 degrees right now. In Valley traffic, an accident to be aware of, 51 southbound at McDowell. In the news this hour, the state Supreme Court is letting stand lower court's ruling that a state voucher program for students with disabilities is constitutional. The justices today, without comment, declined to review an October decision in which the Court of Appeals upheld a judge's 2012 ruling. The rulings rejected opponents' arguments that the Arizona Empowerment Scholarship Accounts Program violates state constitutional prohibitions on using public money to support religious or private schools. The courts also said it is constitutional because parents have discretion on how to spend the money for education costs. The Phoenix City manager has outlined a plan to cut $29 million from the city's budget. That includes reductions to emergency services and the Parks Department. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
The proposed cuts to the Parks Department would total more than $7 million. Parks spokesman David Urbanato says the city summer camps would be the first to close.
If the cuts were to be enacted on July 1, as they are listed today, then we would obviously not be able to offer that program because the centers at which they were offered would be shuttered.
Urbanato says summer swimming and diving teams at 9 city pools would also be eliminated, and 13 community centers that offer fitness classes and sports leagues would be closed if the reduced spending plan becomes a reality. The city will be holding 17 meetings in April for the public to comment on the potential budget. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The state budget is also moving. The Senate yesterday evening signed off on a $9.2 billion budget for the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. The House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to take up that chamber's budget bills on Monday. The Senate plan gives Governor Brewer some of what she wants, but not all. Alan McGuire is president of the McGuire Company. He's worked on a lot of state budgets and likes the fact that there are some different ideas on a new spending plan.
Well, actually, I think it's a terrific thing because the budget is really complicated. There are hundreds of state agencies. There are thousands of line items. And you don't expect everybody to come together in one fell swoop and go, we have the solution. And so the fact that they're having a conversation is great. They're all moving. The fact that they're moving and talking and blending, that's all very positive. It's a good time of year, and it's relatively early still.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon to see a budget happen in May or even in some cases in June. So the fact that it's happening in March, is that unusual from your experience?
It is and it isn't, okay? 20 years ago, there was a push for the original 100-day session concept, and the critical ingredient to a 100-day session was the 65-day budget. Tuesday, just a couple days ago, was the 65th day. So if you think about a 100-day session, they're sort of right on target for wrapping up the budget, because once the budget gets done, things start to close down and they get out of there. And they all want to get out this year. They want to campaign and run for re-election.
Could a legislative proposal be a starting point? I mean, is it a shot across the bow? Is it, hey, this is what we believe? Is this, hey, this is what we're going to do? Go ahead and veto it?
Part of it has to do with the way the legislative leadership sees the politics. Sometimes you do the shot across the bow because then your members feel like they've taken a position, they've been strong on fiscal austerity or whatever it happens to be, and then the governor responds and you volley and serve and parry back and forth for a few times. I have sort of a sense that this year they want to get out of there, so let's skip the first round. Let's start to get right to the final decision making. And some of the actions of the Senate over the last couple of days indicate that they may be trying to get together faster.
How much of the discussions happen between the governor, the Senate president, and the House speaker, and maybe some other members of leadership versus their staffs?
Well, what really happens typically is the leadership and the governor, the elected officials, get together and they make their positions clear. But that's at the 10,000-foot level. Then the staff gets together and figures out how do those details all fit together.
In a situation like this where the state is going to be, it looks like, spending at least a little bit more money in the next fiscal year than in the current one, what is that process like?
It's very hard. Imagine a big family, right? It's easy to say no Christmas gifts this year. It's really hard to say, well, Mary and Bob get a Christmas gift, but the rest of you kids get nothing. That's the real challenge in that situation.
Is it a problem in your mind that the way the budgets seem to work now is that there are closed-door meetings, a budget is introduced, and within at least a day or two, legislators are voting on it?
Well, some people are very dramatically upset by that process. That process typically always happens at some point. What has changed over the last several decades is there's less open-air discussion about the components of the budget before that sort of horse trading begins. And the loss there is legislators get educated through the budget process. They learn about the state agencies and they learn what state government does and what state government doesn't do. And you don't really get that in the small group behind the scenes meetings. It's very educational and very valuable for legislators to understand what does DES do versus what the state forester does versus what the universities do and the three different universities and their roles.
Alan McGuire, president of the McGuire Company. He's also a veteran of many state budgets passed. Alan, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
The Glendale City Council this week voted narrowly to start formal talks with the Tohono O'odham Nation on its proposed resort and casino near 95th and Northern Avenues. The council also decided to formally oppose a bill in Congress that aims to block the project. The two sides have been at odds for several years after the nation bought the land and announced its plans to build the casino. Glendale City Councilman Gary Sherwood voted to start the talks. He says while he still opposes the project, it's time to see if the sides can reach a deal.
When I ran for council, it was against the project based on the sovereignty and the fact that it wasn't going to do anything for the city. You know, why not have the discussion? So we had the first big meeting, and then they had a couple other meetings, and so to the point now where we think we have some common ground, and let's decide to move forward into some, and no one likes the word negotiate, but actually, you know, see if we can come to some salient terms, you know, which for me would be a direct revenue source beyond the gaming compact 12% requirement, you know, and all the infrastructure paid for. And number one is that they would have to, you know, give up sovereignty so that any contracts that we did have would be represented in U.S. court. The lawsuits, we're not pulling back from our investment in our particular lawsuit.
Do you think that it will hurt the possibility of reaching an agreement with the Tohono O'odhams, given that you're talking with them on one hand, but still involved in lawsuits against them on the other?
No, not at all. In fact, I think they were encouraged that the council went ahead and decided to publicly oppose the Trent Franks bill. So that wasn't a couple of days ago. That wasn't even in my purview to do that. It simply was, let's move forward to negotiation. And that would be part of the negotiation, Mark. That would be part of it. You know, we'd get to a certain point where we're willing to give you this, this, and that, and we're willing to do this. And as part of that, will you drop your part of the lawsuit and oppose the Senate bill? There could be a point, if everything goes per their plan, that we get there where staff will present to council and say, we're very comfortable with what we're getting out of this, and part of the negotiation, they want us to drop the lawsuit part of it. But again, that doesn't say because we've dropped our portion of it that there's still other parties, a party to that, and there's the one or two other lawsuits out there.
From your perspective, how much of your decision to vote to open these negotiations or these talks is fiscal versus how much of it is just trying to make the best of what you can out of a potentially bad situation?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, even if we weren't in our fiscal situation, if we have a way to make money independent of what our poor financial situation is now, we owe it to our citizens. If we can make that area stronger and we can drive revenue off from it and lessen the burden on them, then by all means, we should do that.
Since we're talking about a potential casino project, I've got to ask you a question about odds. And I'm curious what you think the odds are now that these talks have been opened up, that this project happens and has the city's blessing and the Tonawanda has what it needs from the city has what it needs from the nation?
There's a long ways to go. It doesn't mean it's a lot. It's that we're talking years or even months, but there's a lot of hurdles that still have to clear. We could very well get to what we want out of this, but then we're tripped up by the courts or by legislation.
Glendale City Councilman Gary Sherwood, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mark.
We did reach out to representatives of the Tohono-O'odham Nation, but they didn't respond to our request for comment. In a statement released earlier this week, Tohono-O'odham Chairman Ned Norris Jr. said in part, quote, "The nation looks forward to working with Glendale leaders and staff to find a way for us to move forward together for the benefit of the entire West Valley."
The presidents of Arizona's three public universities, ASU, U of A, and NAU, have submitted their tuition proposals for the next academic year. Their requests seem relatively modest, with ASU keeping the annual rate for an in-state student at approximately $10,000. Out-of-state undergrads would see a 3% increase. But even if a rate is maintained or an increase is very small, tuition is not going down. Zachary Brooks of the Arizona Students Association Board of Directors and graduate student body president at the U of A says the whole process is frustrating.
Maybe it sounds sad, but I'm used to it because, you know, the state of Arizona and lots of states around the country have decided to invest less and less of their money into higher education institutions. And so, you know, what people at the University of Arizona will say, and I think this probably goes for many places in the country, is that, you know, the percentage of dollars that any of these institutions get is flipped from two-thirds from the state and one-third from students to two-thirds from students in the form of tuition to one-third from the state.
You're a grad student. Is there an even greater disconnect there with an increased emphasis on more practical courses of study?
I think one of the fundamental things we find as graduate students is a lot of people see higher education, you know, professional master's degrees and PhDs, as some sort of privilege, and like, oh, you know, you're going to go get a bunch of money anyway someday. And that might have been the case up to 10 years ago, but law schools around the country, University of Arizona, I know, lowered their tuition last year because they realized their graduates are going out and not always finding jobs. And so I think there's a huge disconnect between what people think, you know, people do and what they actually do and what they can actually get. The second part of your thing, what you were kind of getting at, is there are master's programs at ASU and probably elsewhere too, where there's not necessarily a job market-driven sort of need, something like master's in obesity or something like that. And I mean, isn't that like a master of nursing or a master of public health? I mean, so sometimes it seems like some institutions might want to create a master's degree, which is just a cash cow to the university, without really caring about the student and the person who's going to be going in there. You know, the debt will be borne by that individual later.
A number of schools across the country, including NAU and George Washington University, have acted to give students predictable, unchanging tuition for their freshman through senior years. But Dennis Jones, president of the nonprofit National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, says the trend is no longer moving in that direction.
When economies went south and the states really cut back their funding appropriations to higher ed, they also kind of took the binders off of institutions and kind of turned them loose to raise tuition as much as they wanted to, just to fill in the gaps. So why would institutions lock themselves in when they had free rein?
How much research has to go into how much of a percentage to ask for? How much seems reasonable and how much seems likely to pass?
I think it's pretty much a function of, first question, how much are we likely to get in the appropriation process? Second question is, what do we have to raise tuition to cover inflation, given the appropriation number we're likely to get? And the third question then is, if we raise tuition that much, will we get backlash or not? Is that a number that is politically acceptable or not?
Jones says the most worrisome proposition going forward is balancing the need for more college graduates with who can afford college and how much financial aid is available. The Arizona Board of Regents will hold public hearings on the proposed tuition rates next Tuesday.
Still to come, Arizona is looking at labels and trying to bring in some brand name companies.
If you look at the brand for a country or a state, it's all about the companies that are there carrying your flag.
That's ahead. It's the show. If you're on the Valley Freeway, it's just one problem spot to be aware of. It's on the 51 southbound, an accident blocking the shoulder at McDowell. And if you're stuck in the office right now, you're missing a beautiful day outside. High of 83 degrees under sunny skies. But don't worry, it'll be pretty much that way over the weekend as well. Sunny skies tomorrow and Sunday with highs right around 82 or 83 degrees each day. Right now, sunny skies, 80 degrees at 218.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts, mixing strength, balance, smarts, and fun. The dancers of Palabolas perform original classics and new works March 28th and 29th. ScottsdalePerformingArts.org.
It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm John Hockenberry here in New York. Going to college and getting an education. There's your book learning, and then there is learning the hard lessons of life, in this case, college life.
I came to school not understanding the financial system, not understanding the loans that I was taking on. I have friends that are seniors, and I'm realizing more and more how much debt I'm going to be in once I graduate college.
Student Megan Pierce did not go to Fitchburg State in Massachusetts to learn about banking and finance or to end up with $30,000 in student loans. And learning the consequences of bad financial decisions wasn't part of the curriculum for Nakia McKenzie at St. John's University in Queens.
The debt that I have incurred now, I know I could have probably avoided it had I been more mindful or just, you know, open to knowing that, hey, you can't afford it, you know. I have a couple of friends now who have graduated, and Sallie Mae is knocking on their doors, and they don't know what to do because they're even having tough times even finding jobs now. So, and they have their student loans to pay, and they're just freaking out.
Nakia McKenzie left St. John's eventually overwhelmed with student debt and is now a part-time student at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. These are voices gathered by our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, where they found Mike Wasserman, who's the Massachusetts Executive Director of the Boston-based nonprofit Bottom Line, which helped Nakia McKenzie out of her difficult college situation, and is advising student Jasmine Boyd Perry. Mike Wasserman and Jasmine Boyd Perry join me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So, Jasmine, are you saddled with debt like those hard luck stories we've heard there just a moment ago?
Thankfully, not so much. I've managed to, with the help of my bottom line counselor, figure out my FAFSA and get it in on time. So it's not the worst.
Congratulations. And I'm sure that takes a little bit of the college pressure off. Mike Wasserman, what segment of the population are you looking to most help? And then we'll talk about some of the mythologies about college that kids and parents naturally fall into.
Yeah, so at Bottom Line, our focus is working with students who are first-generation college students who are coming from lower-income families. So really, students who have the motivation, the drive to go to college, but maybe lack some of the social resources or expertise within their family to really navigate what is becoming a more and more complex situation.
Did Nakia and her family, the story of the young woman who went to St. John's and eventually dropped out, were they just in love with the idea of St. John's and were blinded to the financial realities?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a culture of the way we talk about college, which is, you know, just go to your dream school, you know, just make it work. Whatever it costs, you know, it's worth it. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that you have to make more of a buying decision, right? I mean, college is the best investment you can make in your future, but that doesn't mean that every college is. You really have to be smart about making intelligent financial decisions.
Well, being a smart buyer is part of the problem in the sense that sometimes the information isn't readily available. Here's Rachel Fishman, who's a policy analyst from the New America Foundation.
There's differential pricing in higher education, and students can be getting need-based aid, merit-based aid, grants, loans, and all these factors have to be taken into account when making your college decision. And many students aren't able to do that right now because it's a really complicated concept.
Jasmine Boyd Perry, what complicated concepts are you majoring in college? And do you understand what Rachel Fishman is talking about there in trying to figure out the price of your education?
I do understand. Well, right now I'm majoring in psychology and sociology. But when I started out, I was incredibly confused about what it meant. And I applied to multiple schools. I applied to Temple, and I even applied to St. John's. And I got into these schools. But when you get your financial aid package back, you think, this is amazing. I'm getting $20,000. But what does this $20,000 break down to? And then how are you going to make up the extra $30,000? And what does that mean for you? What does it mean for your family? And it wasn't until I talked to my mentor about bottom line and I sat down and I was realistic. It's, do I want to pay this much money for a name, for a dream, when I can get an equal education at a place that costs $10,000, that offers a better package? And sometimes you just have to face the realities of the situation. And that's why I chose UMass Boston.
Mike Wasserman, how difficult is that? I mean, how are you not the character who comes into the family and is basically selling my daughter short? You're the person who says she should accept her economic situation. I reject that. She's going to the best school.
Well, there's a lot of different colleges out there. I don't want to say that, you know, the cheapest school is selling yourself short. I mean, I think we really believe in the public education system. When you think about the Harvards and the Ivy League schools, you know, a student that gets in there from any background, those schools will give you a financial aid package that makes it work. But, you know, a student that is going to choose between, you know, a large private urban school and a large public urban school, it's really just helping that family understand the financial implications of both. And I think we really believe that it's not, you know, you got to go to the worst school. It's just understanding the full decision making that has to go into, you know, buying a school.
Jasmine Boyd Perry, have you managed to put some money away, make some future plans, and not just worry about the debt you're going to be having the moment you graduate?
I've made some money, but it's a balance because I do still have loans. I don't want you to think that I'm going to school scot-free, but it's about what loans I'm willing to take out. Like, I make sure they're all subsidized, so I'm not accumulating, like, interest rates on it. I make sure that if I'm going to take out this loan, that I have a plan to pay it back.
Does Jasmine's lack of pressure and sense of confidence, is that convincing to other people that come to bottom line with the financial problems, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you look at kind of the average student's debt coming out of college now, it's risen to, you know, about $30,000, really gone up significantly over the past decade. And that's just the average. I mean, you know, Jasmine's talking about the loans she's taking out. It's really about $5,000 in subsidized loans. And the pressure is so much lighter when you come out of school. I think it really allows you to do what you want and don't feel the pressure to, you know, get the highest paying job or feel like you're failing if you can't find that perfect position right away. So we've really tried to connect a lot of our current college students to high school students so they can hear some perspectives, right, on what it's like once you go to school and the freedom that good financial decision allows. And also, you know, to your question earlier, talking to students about the real quality that exists in affordable schools through honors programs, through all of these opportunities that, you know, a large public institution can provide or an affordable institution can provide.
Mike Wasserman is the Massachusetts Executive Director of the Boston-based nonprofit Bottom Line, and Jasmine Boyd Perry is a junior at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. More than 100,000 Arizona elementary through high school students will be taking part in a field test for one of the assessments aligned with the Common Core Education Standards. Here, they're called Arizona College and Career Ready Standards. The PARC field testing starts next week and runs for about a month in more than 1,400 schools around the state. Jennifer Lewer with the State Education Department says it's a pretty low-stakes situation for the kids taking the test.
Students are not going to be rated or graded on how they do on this test. It really is about finding out if our systems work, as well as giving our students a chance to take a look at a next-generation test.
PARC is one of a few tests that's aligned with the new math and English standards. The State Board of Education will ultimately pick one of them to replace AIMS. Students should start taking the new test next school year. Pearl Chang Esau, president and CEO of the education group Expect More Arizona, says the next few weeks should give schools a sense of how ready they are for whichever new test the state starts using next year.
I don't think the field test is a tool for assessing whether PARC is the right test for Arizona. I think the field test is more of an opportunity for our schools to do a test run with transitioning to any new test, PARC or any other test.
Esau says the state will pick a new assessment based on a number of factors, including whether the results are comparable across states and the ability to get results more quickly. The Education Department's Jennifer Lewer says the new assessment will likely be a change for many students.
Even if PARC is not the new assessment that we go with, more than likely this new assessment is going to be an online-based assessment. And so making sure that schools have the broadband available, have the resources available, this gives us a chance to ensure that that infrastructure is there.
Lewer says the field test will also benefit the test developers, who can look at the results and make tweaks to questions based on how students answer them. She says the field test is voluntary and that not all classrooms in a participating school will take part. There's also the issue of funding. Governor Brewer has asked for $13.5 million to implement the new assessment in the upcoming fiscal year. Lawmakers appear to be proposing less than that. One of the districts that'll be participating in the field testing is the Peoria Unified School District. Deputy Superintendent Heather Cruz says about 2,900 students across several grades will be taking PARC starting April 22nd.
It is a valuable experience to get a glimpse into this, next generation assessment, to make sure that we're on track and that we're really aligning our resources to be on track with that, as well as to, see how our students perform. How do they react in that situation? So it gives us kind of a glimpse to see, is our preparation correct or do we need to make some course corrections?
How comfortable are you with the technology that your district has as far as having the computers or tablets available for enough students to use them to take the test?
We do not have enough. I'll just be honest. I'm not sure any district has enough. With the cut in capital budgets over the last years, we've lost over $40 million. We have not been able to even replace computers, let alone continue to buy more so that we have enough breadth across our district to, get a whole grade level of students on computers at the same time. We could not accommodate that in our district.
So given that some of your students will be using paper and pencil, some will be doing the online version, will the experience be potentially more valuable to some students than others?
Well, that's an interesting question. Not having seen the assessments, I can tell you that if you take it online, there are technology-enhanced questions that have other pieces to them. It gives students the ability to highlight online, calculators, etc., that, the experience could look very, very different on paper. So it's going to be a very interesting experiment, so to speak, to see how students perform in these two different environments.
Now, as you said, your district doesn't have enough computers. Presumably, there's some other infrastructure needs there as well. So I'm curious, what exactly are you hoping to learn, given that it seems like you know at least some of what some districts would hope to know?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how students react. We do some online testing in our district already with internal assessments, so we have been working towards that, as well as, we are adding to part of the collective good with this assessment. You do need to field test to see what items are valid and reliable, so that in the end, when you really roll out the real assessment, you have a quality assessment. So being a part of that is also, I believe, a good thing and part of what we should do.
Heather Cruz is Deputy Superintendent of the Peoria Unified School District. Heather, thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks, Mark.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name's Patrick Parsons, and I am putting a roof on a house here at Porch Light Homes. After the framers get done doing their framing, and then that'll give us the go-ahead to be able to put tar paper down, the metal edge, and then the roofing material itself, the shingles. With my partner up there, we can do this house in 3 days, maybe fourth. We come across some slow area. Personally, I like, the satisfaction at the end when it's all done. I look back and I can see, hey, I did that.
That's Patrick Parsons putting on the roof of a new home for Porchlight Homes in Central Phoenix. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. In Valley traffic, there's an accident that has closed the southbound lanes of State Route 87 at Gilbert Road. They'll be taken off the highway detour to the 202 Red Mountain Freeway. On the northbound side of State Route 87, the left lane is blocked because of the incident, so expect delays in that area. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today into the weekend. Look for highs in the low 80s. It's 80 degrees right now. This is The Show. What is The Show, you might ask? It's a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and even international news to provide a stream of engaging radio.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners, specialty meats, fine wines, and desserts for spring celebrations. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
The competition to attract a new Tesla lithium battery factory has gotten fierce. Arizona, Texas, and New Mexico are finalists to partner with the electric car maker. New Mexico Governor Susana Martinez says her state is seriously considering a special legislative session to decide what sort of economic incentives to offer. So why are these states so willing to go the extra mile for Tesla? Michael Denning teaches marketing at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business.
In effect, the community is hoping that by bringing one of these high-profile companies in, that it will add a certain degree of attractiveness to the community, meaning that other companies, well, if Apple went there or Google went there or Tesla went there, then there has to be something in that community that's exciting and we want to be part of it and they would come too.
I guess I would put a Google or an Apple, even an Intel, which has been established here for so long, in different categories than Tesla, because Tesla does seem more about, I mean, a very hot company with a very hot brand, some hot products, but that aren't necessarily accessible to all that many consumers. Does that matter at all in going after a brand?
Well, if Rolex decided to put a major distribution system in place in Phoenix, would that create excitement? Yes, there's a degree of exclusivity about that. But I'll be quite frank with you. If Mercedes came into town and wanted to build an assembly plant here, or BMW, or even Cadillac, the community would be excited about that because, again, it's the matter of the prestige of the brand carrying over into the community.
The efforts by Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas to attract Tesla are so public. Do those states look bad if they don't get Tesla, or is the effort worthwhile on its own?
Certainly, it's not as important as actually getting the brand to reside within your state or in your community. But I think the fact that the brand was considering moving here is a plus for Phoenix and in the Valley and Arizona. At least if I were in charge of the public relations department for the state of Arizona, I certainly would be touting that.
And what if Arizona nets Tesla, but the brand's power fades quickly? David Ocker is the author of a dozen books about branding. He says the power of social media can have a dramatic and swift impact on brands.
Everything's moving faster. Brands can get created a lot faster than before. I mean, word of mouth has always been important in creating new brands, but now we've got word of mouth on steroids because of social media. So, yeah, a brand can get in trouble faster, and a brand can come to the fore faster. And another factor is all brands need energy. Energy is really important because it gives you visibility. It gives you, an interest, it gives you a personality, and a brand that comes to the fore quickly, and especially in high tech here, has a lot of energy, and that in itself is a huge thing. And the heritage brands, the ones that have been around time, struggle to create energy.
And the power of brands is sometimes what people identify with a particular state or even a country. Ocker says that was the case with work he's done for South Korea.
The fact is that if you look at the brand for a country or a state or a city or a region, it's all about the companies that are there carrying your flag. I mean, Samsung is carrying the flag for Korea all around the world. LG, it's Hyundai. And the same thing is true in Arizona. So it's the brands that have a big presence in Arizona are to some extent, you know, forming or creating an image of Arizona.
Branding expert David Ocker.
Is there still a place for the symphony, opera, and dance in a Facebook and Twitter world? A conference wrapping up today in Tucson is looking at that question, specifically whether high culture still has a place in contemporary America. Daniel Asia is a professor of music composition at U of A and the director of the Center for American Culture and Ideas, which is putting on the two-day event. So who is posing this question? I mean, where did this question come from?
Well, it really came from me and from the center, because it seems to me that in our culture generally, as well as in academia, this is a very important question for us at this time in our culture and our history.
Why is that?
Well, because I think there are issues and problems with the continuance of high culture. I would say that universities, by and large, have abandoned any responsibility in regards to high culture. In other words, they have made the playing field pretty level in regards to everything, or they consider everything on the same level. I would also suggest that that's also true in the larger culture, that we generally make no distinction between popular music, between orchestral music, between entertainments of various sorts. It's pretty much all the same.
I guess part of the question would have to be, you know, I think that there are some people who would say, well, you're just looking at sort of the elite, you know, culture, or the sort of the snooty culture. You know, what's the difference between, you know, watching a documentary on TV or at a movie theater versus going to hear the opera?
Of course. And I think there is an easy question for that, or answer to that, rather, and that is simply that high art is not snooty. It just tends to be a little bit richer and deeper. And sometimes that means, yeah, it takes a little while to get into it, but actually the rewards are much greater. And that's true pretty much in regards to anything that takes a little bit of time and to get into a better understanding of it. In other words, not everything in our lives can be completely superficial.
So what is your hypothesis? What is your answer to the question that you're posing?
It's interesting. I'm not sure I have an answer other than a very simple one, and that is that for those of us who think that the arts and the classical arts in particular offer something of tremendous richness and excitement and depth, it's on our shoulders to go out, as it were, and to spread the word. The culture makes that a little bit more complicated now because it is such a speedy and, dare I say, superficial one, one that doesn't reward this kind of introspection, if we want to use that word. But for those of us for whom this is something that really matters, we just have to go out and say, hey, come on, let me explain to you why this is so cool.
Daniel Asia is a professor of music composition at U of A and the director of the Center for American Culture and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Arizona has the highest percentage of cigarettes smuggled in than any state other than New York, even when accounting for those bought on Indian reservations. We're not necessarily talking about a dude in a trench coat saying, psst, want to buy some smokes? But Todd Nesbitt, a senior lecturer at Ohio State University who helped work on a study about this for the Tax Foundation, says between 2006 and 2012, Arizona's cigarette tax rate increased 69% and its smuggling rate went up almost 20% to 51.5%.
Generally speaking, the higher tax states, and particularly if you see a state increasing its tax rate on cigarettes, we tend to see that overall smuggling into that state is going to rise.
Now, when you talk about smuggling, are you talking about people driving across the state border to buy cigarettes for themselves and maybe their friends, or are you talking about people buying cigarettes in one state, bringing them to another, then reselling them?
Yes, it's actually both. And so when you cross into another border and buy for your personal consumption, some of that actually is legal. And so, but notice that in terms of its impact on, like when we increase the tax rate in a particular state, its impact on tax revenue that state should anticipate, certainly they need to take into account some of those sales. But also notice that just because sales within the home state may have actually fallen, that doesn't really necessarily mean that health is necessarily improved by that degree if those same shoppers are instead going to buy their cigarettes across the state line.
So Arizona was the second highest smuggling rate in the country, 51.5% behind only New York. What factors do you attribute to Arizona's ranking?
Every single state that borders Arizona has a lower excise tax on cigarettes.
With smoking rates down across the country and in many individual states as well, when you look at a study like this, is it most important to look at the actual rates of cigarette smuggling? Is there maybe a sort of a larger takeaway message from this study?
Yeah, I mean, we do have, within the model, we are picking up the downward trend in overall smoking. And so we are seeing that in there. And certainly the total quantity, I would say, of smuggling, total number of packs, could very well, I don't think there's much of a decline there, but it could very well be on a decline along with what we see with general smoking patterns. This still is quite concerning, not only just from an enforcement perspective and revenue perspective, but also if the intent is to help nudge individuals into making better, healthier decisions for their lives, it doesn't necessarily seem that the excise tax is actually performing that role quite as well as I would say that most people would actually want it to.
Todd Nesbitt is a senior lecturer at Ohio State University and worked on the study on cigarette taxes and smuggling by state for the Tax Foundation. You can take a look at the report for yourself at kjzz.org.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of experts work together to focus on you. Learn which health plans include Mayo Clinic, or you can request an appointment at mayoclinic.org/Arizona.
School at any age can be fun. It's also a place with rules of engagement, which can be difficult, particularly if you're different, like Sophie, who has Down syndrome. Her mom, commentator Amy Silverman, shares her view from the carpool lane.
After two tardy slips in less than a week, I was determined to get Sophie to school in plenty of time to make the bell. And in my rush, I didn't notice that she'd left the house in patent leather party shoes and sweatpants. It wasn't until she'd leaned over from the back seat for several goodbye kisses, handing me the rest of her cranberry juice and climbing out of the car, that I noticed her glasses slipping down her nose. Or the fact that her Olivia the Pig backpack, the one she dug out and insists on using, even though it was her backpack in first grade or maybe kindergarten, looked ridiculous on the back of a fifth grader. Just half an hour earlier, we were giggling and taking photos of her outfit, Sophie posing like a fashion model, or what she thinks one looks like, in a silly poodle t-shirt with our pet poodle on the floor behind her. That was in the bubble of our kitchen. The school is a bubble, too, a place she feels comfortable. It's been home for the last 6 years. But as I saw Sophie head to the playground, I cringed. Almost immediately, she bumped into a gaggle of girls, fellow fifth graders, kids she's been in school with since kindergarten, girls who used to invite her to their birthday parties. I watched Sophie stop next to the girls, hesitate, lean in a little. I watched them completely ignore her. It happened in a matter of seconds. I rolled down my window wanting to yell to her, but what? "Hey, Sophie, no time to stop. You better rush to class." "Hey, Sophie, don't worry about them. Just keep walking." That's what I did when I was in fifth grade. "Hey, Sophie, I love you." In the end, I didn't say anything. As quickly as I rolled it down, I rolled the window back up, embarrassed. Other cars were waiting. As I glanced back one last time, I saw Sophie hesitate another few seconds, looking hopeful. Finally, she shuffled toward the playground, her party shoes a little too big, her hair in her eyes. It was that hope that was so hard to see, hope that has been beaten out of all the other fifth graders who have figured out their rankings on the social hierarchy and know better than to cast a wishful gaze in the direction of someone more popular. Those girls didn't laugh at Sophie or say anything mean. They just looked past her as though she wasn't there. I'm guessing if they hadn't, she would have asked a million questions, invited them all for sleepovers, offered them my cell phone number and a paintbrush from her collection. Too much, I get it. But what does Sophie get? It won't matter next year when all of the kids leave for other schools. Those girls, a huge percentage of the entire fifth grade, in fact, will be going to the academy across the street, the one the district started to compete with charter schools, the one that requires A's and B's, the one I could sue to get Sophie into, if I wanted. Some days, I want to. That day, pulling away from the school, I did not. When I'm gone.
Amy Silverman blogs about her experiences at girlinapartyhat.com. This is Sophie's favorite song from the CD they listen to on the way to school.
What does this sound like to you? Well, it's not the soundtrack to a sci-fi film. What's happening here is actually the result of people interacting with a structure of metal bars crisscrossed to make a half dome. If a hand touches one of the red or blue bars, it will make a certain sound. A bunch of hands can make this.
This sculpture can be found at Spark, Mesa's Festival of Creativity at the Mesa Art Center. There's also a garden made of recycled paper and plastic materials, and a musical playground of tubes and drums that can be played by multiple people at once.
Those are a couple of examples of things that people might otherwise not have seen and that might not have happened if those artists weren't doing them for this event.
Cindy Ornstein is the executive director of the Mesa Arts Center, and she says Spark gives artists, performers, and creators a place to try new ideas. For instance, the Wonder Dome, an IMAX-style theater with a screen and live actors.
It's actually the Wonder Dome's debut here at Spark. The highly technological 30-foot-wide theater was conceived by Daniel Fine, a student at ASU. He and a partner created the theater as their thesis project.
What we're looking to do is to create all kinds of different live performances inside an immersive dome where the sound system, the lighting system, and the projection system are all responsive to both the performers and the audience.
It's a new idea and a big undertaking, so of course Fine expected there might be technical difficulties at the festival.
So we decided to make the dome itself a living character. So when things didn't work, it was sometimes because he's kind of a new dome who just got built and he doesn't always work.
But the Art Center's Ornstein says they don't mind if things aren't perfect.
They have a place to show new work, take those risks of things that might not work out. They may have to try a different thing, or maybe parts of them don't even end up working. But that's okay, because we want to celebrate their efforts.
The event is interactive. You know, here's my art, now touch it. You can hear, touch, explore, and watch it all through Sunday at the Mesa Art Center. It was built as an anniversary gift for an entrepreneur's wife. Today, the home on a hill overlooking Phoenix and the surrounding mountains has become a venue for the public to enjoy. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about an historic mansion.
The Wrigley Mansion was built by chewing gum magnate William Wrigley Jr. The national landmark sits on a 100-foot hill. Did you know the 1,600-square-foot mansion with 24 rooms and 12 bathrooms was the smallest of the Wrigley homes?
The home was designed to be used for entertaining, showcasing to some of their guests.
Ben Sinan is the general manager of the property that now serves as a restaurant, bar, special events venue, and as a museum with daily tours.
And this was a stop on their way west to spend most of the duration of winter before heading back to Chicago.
The Wrigley's also owned homes in California in the Midwest. This one was built between 1929 and 1931. It's right near the Biltmore Hotel. also a Wrigley property at the time. The Spanish Deco Mansion was a 50th wedding anniversary for his wife, Ada.
When this home was designed, downtown Phoenix was still very small. Some of the original pictures we have in the home credit the home as just outside of Phoenix, Arizona.
The luxury home had all sorts of amenities, bedrooms with private bathrooms, a telephone room for guests who make calls, the walls covered with the same aluminum foil paper used to wrap the Wrigley gum, and a remote-control Steinway piano that moves from one classical song to the next, most of them George Gershwin classics, like this one, Rhapsody in Blue. In 1932, William Wrigley died in this house. His family continued to use it until the early 1970s. Since then, the property has sold several times, but each owner has had to preserve its history.
As part of the land deed for the property included that all of the belongings to the home were essentially part of the land, attempting to ensure that you could not part out the valuable pieces of the home.
That includes the Steinway piano. In fact, musicians who visit Wrigley Mansion are still welcome to play it. It's so popular that in 1992, musician Jordy Hormel wanted the Wrigley's Steinway, so he bought the entire house. Hormel's estate has owned the Wrigley Mansion ever since. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
We want to know what you know. Send us a note. The show at kjzz.org.
You might have seen their books or comics or been to one of their museums to see their collection of weird artifacts. Ripley's Believe It or Not exhibits its collections across the globe, but...
Believe it or not...
Yeah, there aren't too many items from the southwestern U.S.
Ripley's is about to change that with a bizarre buying bazaar today and tomorrow in Phoenix.
The Science Center's Michelle Meyer says the museum is in the middle of hosting its first Ripley's exhibit.
A lot of items, like the two-headed calf, has a lot to do with genetics. So when you're in the exhibition, guests can learn about what causes this.
Ripley's VP of Exhibits and Archives, Edward Meyer, says the bazaar will be a little different than what you'll find in the exhibit. Not many people will bring a two-headed calf, for instance.
Certainly the most common thing is what I simply call hobby art, something that somebody has made from an unusual medium.
Meyer says the most exciting hobby art so far was in St. Augustine, Florida.
We had a guy who had three life-size motorcycles on the back of his truck, all made from bones.
Animal bones of all different types and sizes. Meyer says he's never seen anything like it. We'll see if Phoenix can top that. The Science Center's Michelle Meyer says she hopes we can.
We have a great artistic community here that do unique pieces. It'd be great to have something from Phoenix, from Arizona, showcased in one of Ripley's Believe It or Not museums.
You can bring your items to the Science Center lobby. You don't have to buy a ticket to the Science Center if you just want to attend the bazaar. Meyer will be there to give items what he calls an odd appraisal, and if he likes it, he'll buy it for the Ripley's permanent collection.
The Buyer's Bazaar is today and tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The Ripley's Believe It or Not exhibit runs through May 4th at the Arizona Science Center.
If you're looking for something to do this weekend, you can always check out Cher. She's kicking off her world tour tomorrow night at U.S. Airways Center. If you maybe want a laugh, Chelsea Handler, the comedian and host of late-night comedy talk show Chelsea Lately, will be performing tomorrow night at the Comerica Theater. Other musical acts in the Valley this weekend, Michael McDonald, you may remember him from the Doobie Brothers, he'll be performing tomorrow night at Talking Stick Resort. Kenny Rogers, the gambler, will be at Wild Horse Pass Sunday night. And Lady Antebellum will be performing Saturday night at Auction Pavilion in West Phoenix. Elsewhere, the canal convergence at the Scottsdale waterfront through Sunday, art, music, and giant bugs. Those, I assure you, are part of the art. There's also the P83 Street Party at the Peoria Sports Complex, a celebration of spring training. By the way, you can get in free for that with a ticket from the San Diego Padres or Seattle Mariners spring training.
The show was produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, news director Peter O'Dowd, executive producer John Hoban. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD.